I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The first thing Barack Obama said he was going to do after being sworn in as president was close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. There are just 61 detainees still there after 15 were just transferred to the United Arab Emirates. But it's not likely the prison will be closed by the time President Obama leaves office. The population is down from almost 800 detainees during the Bush administration. So what's the future for those who are still there and the facility itself? We've called on Carol Rosenberg to join us. She's been covering Guantanamo Bay for 15 years, was there most of July, and she's a reporter for the Miami Herald, joining us from their studios. And Carol, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me.
So who are the 15 that got released to the United Arab Emirates? Had they been on okayed for some time now, and were they ever charged with a crime or with terrorism?
To unpack that a little bit, 12 of them were Yemeni and 3 of them were Afghans, and they came from countries that the Pentagon and the U.S. administration decided could not be repatriated, in large part not because of who they were, but because of the countries where their home countries are extremely volatile. And what the administration has been seeking to do is find places where they can go into rehabilitation programs and then get on with their lives, eventually be released from what seems like quasi-detention in a rehab program in the United Arab Emirates. None of them were charged with a crime during the Obama years. A couple of them were looked at by the Pentagon prosecutor back in the day when they were sort of scouring the files and trying to figure out if they wanted to charge them. Some of them, I think about half of them, were cleared as far back as the Bush administration by the Bush reviews. The thing about the Yemenis is they've been at the back of the line for a long time. And I think the importance of the consequence of this particular 15 detainee transfer into the United Arab Emirates is it shows how much the Obama administration has invested in the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, the Persian Gulf countries, trying to find Arabic-speaking settings that are offering rehab programs for men who've lost basically 14 years of their lives in American prison settings.
What is the track record? And I do want to talk about the 61 who remain at Guantanamo. What has been the track record, for instance, at the UAE when they have accepted some of these detainees?
So now they have 20 there as a total, and we don't know what happened exactly to the first five. They went into the same program, and as far as I can tell, they haven't come out yet. The UAE, I am told, is going to allow them to have visits from family, which is really important to these men. This is nothing that the U.S. was ever able to arrange at Guantanamo, family visits. And then what I was told is they go from this rehab program to maybe halfway house living. Halfway house style living, and then perhaps after a year or two, unclear whether or not they get travel documents and could get together with family somewhere else. But I think the goal is to, if they're married, get their wives there. If they're not, have family back in Yemen, send their wives, send them wives, arrange marriages. And in the instance of the three Afghans, one of the 15 who was sent there, their family over in Afghanistan has already said they're, you know, ready to get going and go to the UAE to see this father and brother who was captured years ago in Afghanistan.
Let me just a quick follow up. You said the U.S. was never able to arrange family visits. I mean, the U.S. has been running this facility. Why haven't they been able to arrange family visits?
Well, at first there was no interest in it. Absolutely. It took a couple of years. I think 5 years, I'm trying to remember, for them to get phone calls. It started off with ICRC letters. And then a couple of years back, the Red Cross approached the Southern Command, which is the Pentagon's subsidiary that kind of runs Guantanamo. And they said, you know, would it be possible for the men who were cleared in particular, but for the Red Cross to arrange in certain instances for them to have family visits? And the answer from the general, a Marine at the time, was that As far as he was concerned, there could be family visits, but there couldn't be sleepovers. And I'm not talking about in the prison. I meant that they were asking the Red Cross to figure out how to pick up someone from Yemen or pick up someone from Afghanistan, get them to Cuba for part of a day, for part of a meeting, and then get them off the base. And I, you know, I go to the base regularly, and logistically, that's pretty, very difficult. And there, and so it's sort of the idea of family visits, especially for those who were cleared for release years ago, kind of came to a dead stop on the idea that the Red Cross wouldn't be able to get them on and off the base, as opposed to letting them stay in the guest quarters and hotels and all of the empty rental space that's available on the base outside the prison.
Let's talk about now there are 61 detainees left. How many of them have been charged with a war crime?
10 are currently in charges. Best known among them are the five men accused of the 9/11 plot who are still in pretrial proceedings as they try to figure out exactly how to bring this case to trial in the court that George Bush and Barack Obama built after 9/11. I mean, you remember this is the military commission's the war court. It's a new interpretation of an old concept of military tribunals. And these men, okay, so there's the five who are accused of 9/11, and there's the man who's accused of putting together the USS Cole bombing, and those six people are awaiting trial in death penalty charges. So the outcome of that would be military execution. And then we have three others who have pleaded guilty with their sentences postponed to see what they can do in terms of perhaps turning government witness at one of these trials. And so they've pleaded guilty to lesser charges. And once they get their sentence, would have theoretically an end date for their time at Guantanamo. And then there's the 10th man, Ali Hamza Balul, who was convicted years ago of being a propagandist, creating video recruiting films for Al-Qaeda, for Osama bin Laden. And he basically boycotted his trial, was convicted and sentenced to life. And his lawyers have been chipping away at that conviction through appeals courts outside of the military judicial system to basically challenge the legitimacy of this court. 10 men of the last 61 in some aspect of a war crimes proceeding.
Now, we could do a whole hour on Abu Zubaydah. He was waterboarded. He has been called, or perhaps was called, a senior leader of Al-Qaeda. He spoke recently. I guess there was some kind of a hearing that he had. Were you able to observe that?
I was not. You had to be in one specific location at the Pentagon in order to see a very short slice of it in which he was not allowed to speak. So they have these parole hearings and that where the media can watch in the Pentagon, and the accused is brought, or sorry, the prisoner, the detainee is brought to a video site in Guantanamo and sits there while descriptions of his behavior are read. The feed gets cut and then he's allowed to speak. What's interesting about Abu Zubaydah is he has never been charged with a crime. He was the first big high-value detainee that was experimented on by the CIA with its enhanced interrogation techniques, waterboarded, put in a cage, left nude, hot, cold temperatures. Sort of the CIA was experimenting with what they called learned helplessness to try to get them to spill Al-Qaeda secrets. What's interesting about Abu Zubaydah is he has argued all along that he's not Al-Qaeda, that he was a rival, that he's not saying he wasn't a jihadist. He's just saying that bin Laden had his organization and Abu Zubaydah had his. And therefore, he's always maintained that maybe he's the Hertz to bin Laden's Avis.
Oh, wow.
And so that's not why he hasn't been charged, but that's part of the issue. They've never linked him directly to the 9/11 plot. And the proof of that is he's not one of the five men charged in it.
Wow. One of the things that you wrote, Carol, is that Guantanamo is the most expensive prison on earth. It costs the U.S. taxpayers $445 million a year. If we're down to 61 detainees, and you say they're 33 soldiers/civilians per detainee, why 33-1? Why so many to watch them?
Because if you remember the big hunger strike of 2013, when the military I mean, it was basically an uprising. Over 100 of the 166 prisoners at the time refused to eat. And the military just poured in extra troops, extra medics, extra soldiers, extra guards in order to lock everybody down into a single cell. And it was a operation that I think troubled them because it took them so long to pull off. That hunger strike went on for weeks, if not months, before they were able to lock everybody down and get them under supervision. So what we have now is the commander down there, who's an admiral, who arrived within the past year saying, I want to be able to react instantaneously if all 61 of the people don't follow the guard's instructions. So what he has is the most robust force ever, frankly, in the history of Guantanamo, because there's so many guards down there. The other problem is, frankly, it's a bureaucracy that doesn't turn off. Somebody would actually have to make the decision to stop military police units from, you know, let's say Pennsylvania or Florida or North Dakota, from forming up. These are National Guard and Reserves. And so they leave their jobs, they get their new uniforms, they go off and train, and they pile into Guantanamo in groups of 100 or so in a constant rotation every month of military police who act as temporary guards at the detention center. So you've got this entire organization that's been created years ago that nobody has thrown the switch to turn off. And it's a valid question for the taxpayers. What are we paying for? I think what we're paying for at this point, if you look on their website, is a lot of training exercises. They're rehearsing. And National Guard people who would be home with their families are now down there rehearsing all sorts of different scenarios, including riots, and other kinds of things that the military police would do in an actual other setting than Guantanamo, where you only have 61 detainees, of which a third or a quarter to a third are already in lockdown in single cell detention. So they're talking about having this robust staff to put down or to handle maybe 30 or 40 detainees who don't cooperate with their guards.
Carol, we're almost out of time here, so an unfair question here. Do you anticipate or even imagine that Guantanamo Bay would ever be closed, the detention facility?
Certainly not during Barack Obama's time. The obstacle to that is that by the end of his administration, there could be 30 or 4 detainees because 20 of the prisoners who are there now are cleared for release. And the Pentagon and the State Department could find places to send them. But closing Guantanamo requires moving the last prisoners to the United States, putting them in some sort of detention. It doesn't mean opening the doors and letting everybody go. And Congress has blocked it, and the president has shown an unwillingness to defy Congress and figure out an end run around Congress to move the last prisoners out to the U.S. and close it down. So certainly not anytime soon.
And a President Trump said he would load it up with bad dudes. Carol Rosenberg, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Reporter for the Miami Herald. She's been covering the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay for 15 years and was there most of July. After this short break, we'll be talking about watch lists. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. The government has been keeping secret lists of people they suspect of having ties to terrorist organizations or sympathies to such group. Senator Bob Corker said recently that no one understands how these lists are put together, how they get adjudicated, and how to get off, and he's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. A recent New York Times editorial had this headline, "Who will watch the watch list?" Well, our guest has similar concerns. Hina Shamsi is director of the ACLU National Security Project and joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And let me give out the phone number and also a way to join our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments? Hina, I know there's more than one list. How many lists are we talking about?
Well, there are actually multiple lists that make up part of a massive government watch listing system. These lists include what's called the Master Watch List, which is the terrorist screening database. And information from that is put into subset lists like the no-fly list, which identifies people who are banned from flying, select P lists, which include people who are subjected to additional screening every time they seek to board an airplane, and something called a known or suspected terrorist file, which is shared with state, local, and other law enforcement around the country. And the thing with these lists and the entire system, first of all, they are massive. They have grown exponentially in the last 14, 15 years.
Do we know how many people are on all these lists together?
The latest information that we know is, as of this summer, which is that the FBI has said that the people on the master watch list contains approximately 1 million person records.
And are they Americans? Are they foreigners? A mix of different nationalities?
It is both Americans and foreigners, more people who are not American. A massive list. But here's the thing about it, which is what makes all of this so sort of problematic and I think needs to be broken down a little bit, which is that the system itself is error-prone and unreliable because it uses very vague and overbroad criteria and secret evidence to put people on these blacklists. And it does that without a meaningful process for them to correct government error and clear their names.
And it's this reasonable suspicion standard. And I realize, you know, that can have many different meanings.
It can. Now, that's the basic standard for inclusion on the master watch list and virtually all of the other lists except for the no-fly list. But let's look at that standard. It's low. Reasonable suspicion is one of the lowest standards you can have. But when you actually try and parse through the standards for reasonable suspicion of inclusion in the master watch list, you realize that it is circular and confusing. It essentially boils down to the government saying it can watch list people if they are suspected of becoming suspected terrorists. That's word soup. And it gets a little bit worse when you go through the criteria because the government specifically says that concrete facts aren't necessary to meet this reasonable suspicion word soup and that people can be watchlisted based on information that is questionable or of suspect reliability. And so with a standard that low, it's unsurprising that there are so many errors. And I think most people don't realize that when the government talks about a watch list of known or suspected terrorists, well, known sounds very reasonable. These
Sure.
are people who've been indicted, arrested, charged with a crime. But suspicion based on suspicion is a very perilous endeavor.
How would someone know, or maybe they wouldn't necessarily know they were on a watch list, let's say a terror watch list, or even the no-fly list, until they have some kind of interaction with the government?
Well, that goes to another part of this, which is that the government has largely, except for the no-fly list, kept people's status secret. Now, there are ways in which that status can become clear. For example, if you're on the no-fly list, as you know, clients we represent in a lawsuit challenging the redress process have been, you can be very publicly barred from boarding an aircraft. You can be, you know, stigmatized when you're surrounded by law enforcement in an airport and told that you cannot fly. And then it becomes clear. Another way is if you're continually subjected to additional screening, it can become clear that way. But for other parts of the watch list, for example, the known or suspected terrorist file, which is shared with law enforcement around the country, people often don't know that if they are, for example, stopped for a traffic stop, the status of inclusion on that watch list may come up for their local police force who are instructed to keep it from them.
What about if someone were applying for a job? I'm just trying to imagine some scenarios. Would it be possible for a prospective employer to know that someone wanting to work for their facility was on a watch list?
Yes, that is certainly possible. So if you're applying for particular jobs that might require a form of government license or accreditation, that could become known. So I think what we're sort of boiling down to here is that the consequences of being placed on these watch lists can be very severe. and can result in, you know, denial of ability to travel by air or sea. And then also, you know, which I hear from people who've been watchlisted or clearly shown to be watchlisted, there's a real stigma and shame and fear and uncertainty that comes when the government imposes on you probably one of the most unpopular labels of our time, which is that you're a suspected terrorist.
How do you fight that? I mean, how do you if you end up being pulled out of the airport line because you're on this watch list and you should not be there, what's the recourse?
Well, that's one of the things that we've been fighting for a while now, which is a fair process. And we've done this in the context of the no-fly list, which can have, you know, a particularly negative outcome and consequence because, as I think we all know, flying can be just part of regular life, right? You could do it for work, to be with family at times of happiness or crisis. It's for any number of reasons. And what used to happen until we won a ruling in our lawsuit is that the government says that it will refuse to confirm or deny a person's inclusion on the watch list, that it refuses to provide any basis for its inclusion of people on the watch list, and that there isn't a hearing at which they can personally show their credibility or contest the government's evidence. Now, in our lawsuit challenging the redress process for the no-fly list, the judge in our case said that that was unconstitutional. And with respect to the no-fly list, the judge ordered the government to come up with a new process. Now, unfortunately, we think that process still violates due process under the Constitution, because although the government will now, at least only for the no-fly list, confirm whether you're on the list if you challenge inclusion, it still refuses to provide all of the reasons for inclusion, the evidence or basis for those reasons, including evidence that undermines the government's reasons for placing you, or a hearing at which you can make your case to a neutral decision maker and challenge government witnesses' biases or hearsay or unreliability. Those kinds of things are the fundamentals of due process, and people aren't getting it with respect to the no-fly list. They're certainly not getting it with respect to inclusion on any of the other lists.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Hina Shamsi, director of the ACLU National Security Project, joining us in this portion of Radio Times talking about watch lists. I'm using the plural there. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. I do want to talk about these lists and also the Second Amendment. But I was reading in some of the research for the show today that Ted Kennedy was on a watch list. Representative John Lewis has been on a watch list. Nelson Mandela was on a watch list. Cat Stevens was on a watch list. Is this, I mean, these are high profile people. One would think in a system that somehow the system would reject these people for being on some kind of a watch list.
Well, you know, people can be erroneously included for reasons like their name matching someone else who might in fact be legitimately, you know, an actual known terrorist. So there is that. But I think what you're pointing to is that, you know, history shows that throughout, you know, the use of watch lists, and again, the watch list system that we have now is unprecedented in its size, that it can sometimes be used for political purposes, right? Nelson Mandela was at a period of time seen as a suspected terrorist. You know, it's hard to know what the basis is for including other people who are political leaders and civil rights leaders. But what it sort of, again, goes back to is that if the government is going to embark on something that is as unreliable as prediction, and that actually became clear, Marty, in our lawsuit, which is when the government was saying its system was fair, it essentially said, we admit we're relying on predictive judgments that people who have never been charged with a violent crime might commit a terrorist act at some point in the future. So think about that. That these kinds of minority report-like predictions are now part of a system that results in deeply negative consequences.
Let me get Ed from Villanova to join our conversation. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you. Wasn't a former head of the NSA quoted in the newspapers as saying that that they have used metadata, as he called it, to assassinate people?
Can you take that? Go ahead, Ed.
One more thing. Didn't Bill Clinton's anti-terrorist act, didn't that eliminate habeas corpus? Do we still have habeas corpus?
Well, you
in
know,
country?
Ed, I'm going to take your first question only because I think it's related to what we're talking about here. Hannah, can you take that? And if the NSA is talking about metadata, is that the same thing as these watch lists?
It's not quite. So metadata is, you know, information that can be gathered electronically, among other ways, that actually tells people a lot, the government a lot about people's lives and how they move. And it's certainly the case that it is part of the information or information that the government might be relying on in placing people on watch lists.
Let me ask you about, and this came after the horrendous shooting in Orlando, I should say massacre, Omar Martin, and actually been on the shooter had been on a watch list, I believe, two times. But after that terrible massacre, some were saying, look, if you're on a watch list, you should not be able to purchase a gun. Your organization opposes this. Explain why.
Well, you know, the issue, especially of gun control, came back exactly as you're saying after that horrific tragedy in Orlando. And, you know, we think that certainly that Congress can reasonably regulate the possession of firearms, and there are ways of doing that. But it shouldn't be using the watchlist system for doing it. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, they were hearing about watchlists at the same for the first time. And here again, you know, it sounds reasonable to say, why don't we use a system for known or suspected terrorists in order to prevent people from buying guns? But it's only reasonable when you don't break down what that system exactly is. And so our view is that, you know, if the government is going to use a watch listing system, it requires massive, massive overhaul because the criteria are vague and overbroad. The redress process is unfair for the reasons that we just talked about. And we don't think that's happening.
The fact that, and this is since September 11th, obviously this expanded watch list, is that because, and is that connected to expanded more surveillance?
I think it's connected to expanded surveillance. I think it's connected to these very, very broad criteria. And, you know, part of the concern also here is the ways in which, when the criteria are so broad, when they're based in, you know, First Amendment protected conduct or association, the reason that there's constitutional doctrine in our country that says we shouldn't have vague and overbroad criteria is because that invites and creates an incredibly high risk of arbitrary discriminatory enforcement by law enforcement. And that's been borne out by the ways in which it has become clear the watch listing system has been used arbitrarily and discriminatorily against people from American, Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities who are disproportionately included on this list.
I quoted that editorial from the New York Times, who will watch the watch list, also quoted Senator Bob Corker, Republican from Tennessee, And it sounds as if who is supposed to provide the kind of oversight of these watch lists?
So the government says that its system is fair because it's got these criteria and that there's an internal review process and really no more is necessary. But that, you know, for all the reasons that we've just talked about, the criteria inadequate, the internal review process, essentially creates assumptions in favor of watchlisting as opposed to taking people off the list. And so there are multiple ways in which our system provides oversight, which include that Congress can do much more in order to revamp the system to ensure that the criteria are not vague and overbroad, to provide a meaningful process for innocent people who've never committed crime to clear their names of government suspicion. And we are hoping that the court in our case also finds that this is unconstitutional.
I mean, it sounds like if Bob Corker, I'm sure there are other members of Congress, are feeling this way. Do you imagine, we're almost out of time here, Hina, that there will be some movement, some changes to what we've been talking about?
Well, you know, we've been seeking movement and changes, I'd say, for well over a decade now. And while there have been some improvements, they are entirely inadequate. And we still have a system that is unfair, error-prone, unreliable, that requires this massive reform. I'm not sure I see that happening at all in a partisan environment, in sort of a environment in which, you know, leading politicians are seeking to advance fear. But what we need is reason and reasonability and fairness.
Hina Shamsi, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Director of the ACLU National Security Project. And coming up, one more issue to talk about related to national security. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You probably noticed that there have been some high-profile cyber hacks and attacks recently at the Democratic National Committee at the National Security Agency and at some state voter registration systems. In fact, the FBI sent out a nationwide alert about them, and there are concerns that Russia could be interfering with this year's presidential race. What is going on? We asked Bruce Schneier to join us. He's a cybersecurity and privacy expert, also fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, a lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and a board member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Bruce Schneier, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Bruce, are we seeing an increasing number of hacks into either government or government-related sites and agencies?
I don't think we are. I think some stuff has just made the news recently, so we are seeing increasing headlines about it. But I'm not convinced there is any uptick globally on a cyber attacks on governments. We as the United States have been attacking other governments for years, and we have been attacked for years. So, I mean, there's more some high-profile stuff around the election.
Right.
But no, I don't think there's any change this year from other years, no.
Do you think, just picking up on a couple of things out of the news more recently, but do you think Russia is involved in any way in any of these hacks that we've been experiencing the last month or two?
It does seem likely. Russia has been engaging in espionage against the United States really since the Soviet Union came into existence. And with the advent of computers and networks, they're attacking there. It does seem that the attack against the DNC and the Clinton campaign was the work of the Russian government. And what that is about, we don't know. That it might have to do with the release of NSA documents. There's a lot of complex geopolitics going on in secret. So all we can do is really guess at what's going on here. But yes, it does seem that Russia was the perpetrator of the DNC hack.
Do you see any connection between WikiLeaks and the Russian government hacks?
Not really. WikiLeaks is the vehicle that was used to release some data, but that's because they're a convenient vehicle. There are lots of ways to release data, and if they didn't exist, they would be released some other way. So at this point, WikiLeaks is a conduit Julian Assange personally hates Hillary Clinton, I think, because he believes she's responsible for his exile and house imprisonment in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. But I don't see them really as a player here, more as a conduit.
Do you imagine or think that there could be a possibility that Russia is somehow going to skew the results of our election this year?
Yeah, it feels really unlikely, but it is certainly possible, if not Russia, that somebody is. Certainly releasing data about one of the major parties, one of the candidates, is an attempt to sway popular opinion in the election. And we can't deny that. But actually fiddling with the process, either the voting rolls or the voting machines, that's a big deal. And that's something that I don't think is likely by a major government. It's more likely by a partisan group of amateurs who would try that, who are in favor of one or the other candidate, and it could be either, and try to skew the results in key states and key areas. So while that's a possibility, I really don't think that it's likely that Russia would do it.
Are you saying that it could be more an inside job, if I can use that, which would be a more partisan attack within this own country?
I wouldn't think an inside job. I would say an American doing it, sure. I mean, this is the internet, right? It doesn't matter where you live. Everything is adjacent to everything else. I think it's more likely that somebody with actual stake in the election. I mean, we live in a very hyper-partisan political climate, and you can easily imagine somebody trying to jigger the results, as their way of helping. I think that's a risk we have to take very seriously.
Absolutely. Do you see our electoral system? I remember when people were very concerned about the voting machines and whether there was a paper trail. And now, of course, we have more online voting than we had a couple of cycles ago. Do you see our voting system as vulnerable to hacks and attacks?
Very much. All analysis we've done of the machines are very hackable. You mentioned paper trails. That's critical. That's machines that are called DRE, which are basically touchscreen computers that have no paper trail, are highly vulnerable to manipulation. And there's no way to verify that the votes were counted. And there are some swing states that use these machines. And now this is a hard conversation to have, but it's one we need to have now before the election. Because if we have it afterwards, then whoever won is not going to be interested in looking at the vote. The one who lost is, and it becomes partisan. Only now we can have this conversation where on whatever side you're on, you might be in favor of more accuracy and less hacking.
You mentioned a couple of swing states that have these systems. Can you be more specific?
There are maps on the internet. Verifiedvoting.org is a good site to go to find out what machines are used where. I know Pennsylvania is one that uses a lot of the DRE machines, and that is a state that is in play. But I don't have the data in front of me, and it's worth looking up.
Sure.
Which states are vulnerable to this kind of thing. And it's not just the machines. I worry about three different aspects of the system. There are the voting rolls, that going in and changing the voting rolls or deleting the voting rolls could have a great impact on the vote. The machines itself we just talked about. And then finally, the tabulation, like collecting all of the individual tallies and determining the overall winner. That's also done on computers. And that's also vulnerable to hacking. Those are the areas I think we have to really pay attention to.
Is that fixable in the next couple of months, what you just described?
A lot of it is not. I mean, certainly for things like voting rolls, we need paper trails now, so that if there are any problems, we can go back to the paper. The machines, we're not going to buy new machines in a few weeks. So if you're voting in a place with bad machines, you're kind of stuck voting with those bad machines. Fight for better machines for the next election. For the tabulation system, again, we can do more audits. We can do more of it manually. And I think there's a lot of value in doing that and just paying attention more to the risks here. It's interesting that elections have two purposes. The one is to choose the winner,
right,
and the other is to convince the loser. And for a safe transition of power, the loser has to believe that he lost fairly. And so voting integrity is really about that as well. So when we have systems that we can't trust, then there's every reason for the loser to say, you know, this was an untrustworthy system. I don't trust the result. And that can be very damaging, even without any actual hacking.
I'm sure you've heard this argument before, which is that, you know, many of us, we bank online. We do a lot of things online, feeling that we have, you know, a pretty high degree of confidence that that information is secure. But it seems like our voting systems are so much less secure than that. Why is that?
That's right. And there's actually a very simple reason, anonymity. If it wasn't for the secret ballot, voting online would be trivially easy to secure. That trivially is a bad word. Would be easy to secure, just like banking. The thing about banking is if there's a problem, we know who did what. We can go back. We can figure it out. We can undo it. Because of the anonymity requirement, because of the secret ballot, many of the security mechanisms we can use for things like banking, we can't use for voting. And that makes it a much, much harder security problem. And that's why there's no such thing as secure internet voting.
Well, you know, so interesting to hear you say that. I have to say, a little troublesome on top of that. We've, you know, as a country, we've spent the last decade or so talking about things like voter fraud, in person impersonation, people pretending to be somebody else.
Which pretty much actually never happened.
Well, I was just going to say, and there's almost absolutely no evidence of that. But what I hear you saying, Bruce Schneier, is that we should be much more concerned about the machines that we use.
Right. And that's, we call that election fraud, as opposed to voter fraud, election fraud. And there have been no confirmed instances of machine election fraud to date. So right now we're hypothetical. We have seen in local elections many instances where the machines are obviously wrong, but it's probably a mistake. So there was a vote, I forget which state, where the machines accidentally dropped 10% of the votes. Just 1 out of 10 votes wouldn't record. So at the end of the day, they opened the machines. There were fewer votes cast than people voting, and they had no way to figure that out. There have been instances where the machines accidentally switched a vote for one candidate for a vote for the other. And these are the things that were found, and some fixable and some not. You know, we know the machines make mistakes. And, you know, the problem is, in an election like this, how do you verify your total?
That's Bruce Schneier. He's a cybersecurity and privacy expert. We've been focusing a lot on voting and the machines that we use for voting and some of these cyber hacks that we've been reading about. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Bruce, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the Watergate break-in. I mean, how old-fashioned that feels with, you know, the plumber from the White House going in and breaking into the DNC headquarters at the Watergate Hotel.
But in some ways, this is the modern analog of that, the DNC hack. I mean, it was done by a foreign country, but it's the same thing, breaking into a political party, into a candidate, and stealing data for partisan gain. You know, in the 70s, you had to do it with black bag men sneaking into a building late at night. You know, in the 2010s, you can do it remotely by attacking computers. And this is just how we keep our data.
One of the things I read about some of the attacks at the DNC and perhaps even some of these statewide voter registration systems is that the hackers might have been more interested in just getting personal information than monkeying around with our electoral system. Do you think there might be some truth to that?
Certainly for the hacks against the two states, I think it was Colorado and Illinois that the FBI talked about earlier this week. Those don't seem like attempts to manipulate the election. Those very much seem like traditional criminal hackers getting data for identity theft. And whether they got anything useful or it will be used to commit fraud, we don't know. But I think that's much more likely than someone doing a dry run for election manipulation in this case. Not that that couldn't be done, but this doesn't seem to be an example of that.
What can you tell us about the hack of the National Security Agency, the NSA?
So this is an interesting, and it's related to this, that a couple of weeks ago, there was an anonymous leak of data, which were NSA cyber attack tools. And so They were released on a website. There was a weird message about an auction, but none of that seemed to be real. But this is actual NSA data. It is secret cyber weapons. Is probably the best way to put it. Who did this? We don't know. It is commonly believed that this was the Russians who did the attack and did the leak as a warning to the Obama administration not to penalize them for attacking the DNC. So a lot of spy versus spy, wheels within wheels. We actually don't know any of this for sure. This is all speculation. But it does seem like that attack against the NSA, which occurred in 2013, even though the leak was a couple of weeks ago, was the actions of a nation state and not of a hacker. I mean, no hacker is going to piss off the NSA. That's just a disaster.
Because the NSA will get them?
Because it just seems like a bad enemy to have.
Is this cyber warfare, what you just described?
You know, this is not. So we use these terms pretty precisely. We use attack to signify things that actually cause damage. So shutting down a power plant would be a cyber attack. This is all espionage. This is all stealing of data. So if someone manipulated the voting machines, that would be an attack. Whether it's an act of war is a separate question. But if someone is stealing data, that is an act of espionage. And it is something that the U.S. does it well as well. So if you remember in last year, the OPM breach, we believe China broke into the Office of Personnel Management and stole personal data on pretty much all U.S. government employees. This was very carefully not called an attack by the U.S. government because it was espionage. And you had the former head of the NSA getting on TV and saying, you know, we would have done that to China if we could ourselves. And so espionage is considered business as usual and something we all do. Attacking is something else entirely.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, and even going back to the voting machines and the upcoming election, I mean, just how vulnerable are we, and just how worried are you that whoever wins in November, there will be questions about whether they won fair and square?
You know, I'm moderately worried. I mean, doing this is actually a big deal. You know, we could talk about the vulnerabilities and they're there, but actually pulling this off is a lot harder than it seems at first. And I don't think it's likely. Whether one side or the other will claim that the election was stolen, you know, that's a much more political issue, much more social issue. And there, I think that's more likely. It really depends. If it's a blowout, no one's going to say anything, right? If one side wins and they have five states more than they need, no one will say anything. But if it's very close, then you could easily point to the machines, point to the voting rolls, point to the systems, point to all these processes that are filled with errors.
Well, Bruce, you have completely depressed us, but I thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
But it's important to vote. Do not vote.
Thank you for
Tell
saying that.
Tell everybody that.
You
that
just
is,
did.
It's vitally important. It's, if you don't vote, it's like they. It's just the same as they stole your vote.
I hear you. Bruce Schneier, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
He's a cybersecurity and privacy expert and also a board member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and teaches at Harvard. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Sign up for our newsletter. Listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.